Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. Our guest tonight is Gregory Luce. Gregory, are you there? Gregory, are you there?
Yes.
All right.
I am here.
All right.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
like yours will be, okay. Great.
Okay. Welcome to the program. Welcome to the program. Technology at its finest. Technology at
yes,
its finest.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Well, let
you.
Me ask you
glad
a question.
Glad to be here.
Sure. Thank you. I'm so glad that you are here. Why is poetry important?
Okay, that is a good question. It's also a sort of hard question because I can think of multiple points of view to answer it from. So I'm just going to take two. Personally, it's important to me because as a practitioner, it gives me a way to say certain things in certain kinds of language that are otherwise not accessible, not things that I might find easy to say in prose or in a letter to the editor. It also just gives me a chance to exercise my imagination in language form, which seems to be something that I have some gift for. I also think it's important to the culture at large for almost some of the same reasons. I think people hear things and see things and are given things to think about that are outside the normal informational channels, like it's more than what you see on Facebook or Twitter. It's deeper and broader and maybe higher than what you get from a newspaper or a TV show. I think it's because it's language at its most highly charged, and I think people really need that. I need to be able to express it, and I think people need to hear it.
Oh, great. I like that. You need to be able to express, and people need to be able to hear it. What are some of
right.
the predominant themes of your work? You've published extensively.
Okay.
What are some of the predominant themes?
Yeah, I've been giving that one a lot of thought, not just for this interview, but in general lately. Some of it is going to be, I'll talk about it in terms of subjects and some of it in maybe some of the broader implications. Some of my, you know, most recurrent subjects, and these are in no particular order, are clouds, the sky, weather, landscapes, especially the landscape of the Great Plains, Texas and Oklahoma, where I grew up. Of course, love always comes in with almost any poet. Sometimes an occasional political statement. It's not something I'm very comfortable with, not because I'm against it, but because I don't think I have the gift for it that some writers have, but it does occur to me from time to time. I think I talk about loneliness and also sometimes trying to give voice to just feelings that are hard to express in normal conversation, but that with the right amount of delicacy and perhaps with choosing an image or a set of images that evoke that particular feeling, it might communicate.
Well, let's begin this journey. Please share some
okay.
of your work.
All right. Well, what I would like to do first is I'm going to read the first poem in my first chapbook, which was published in 2009. It's called Signs of Small Grace. That's the name of the book. The poem is called Just Look, and it's rather short, and I wanted to lead with this because, in a way, it sums up a lot of what I see as my my obligation, my duty, what I try to do with my own poetry. Just
all
look.
Right.
Sunlight falls indifferently among grass and leaves and broken glass and gravel, but the radiance is there anywhere you care to look. Sparks and dazzles fly out and upward. Daytime fireflies glancing off the sidewalk and the puddle and the windshields and, yes, your own eyes when you catch glimpses of yourself in the shop windows. Thanks.
How does a poem begin for you? Is it primarily an idea, a form, or an image?
It varies a little bit, I think, probably as it would for anybody. But mostly, either there is some phrase that gets stuck in my mind, and it may be something that suggests a title, or it just may be a few words. Occasionally, I will have an experience of the actual, you know, phenomenal world that produces an image. Like I might see a particular cloud or set of clouds in the sky here in Northern Virginia that reminds me of something I experienced as a child and has sort of an emotional impact. So other times, I just may remember something and it'll come back as an image. And if I'm lucky, eventually I might be able to work it into a poem. I think
right.
A lot of times it's usually the words first, but not always.
All right. Well, please share another.
I have an example of something like that whenever you're ready
okay.
for it. So.
I'm ready for it, yes.
Okay, good. Good. Let me make sure I have the correct volume here. It's probably better if I just bear with me for one moment, please.
Oh, no, not a problem. Not a problem.
And the reason I want to read this particular one is that this is possibly a slightly extreme example of how something can start out as a couple of words and end up being turning into a poem, and the process may take literally years. This poem is called Some Grackles. Grackles, as you probably know, as most of our audience should know, is a kind of bird. It's a large, shiny black bird. They're very noisy. They often come in large flocks. They're sometimes considered to be a nuisance, but I actually find them rather attractive. But in any case, a number of years ago, I was driving from here to Ohio along Interstate 70. I think it was still in Western Maryland. And I'm a bird watcher, and so birds catch my eye, whether I'm really specifically looking for them or not. And I happened to notice two or three grackles alongside the roadside. And I just said, oh, there's some grackles. And that phrase, some grackles, stuck in my mind. And I kept thinking, I've got to write that poem. And it took about 4 or 5 years before the rest of it actually came to me. So,
all right.
And another reason that I want to read it is because one of your questions, as you suggest when we were first communicating about this, is what are poems that I'm especially proud of? This is one of them, primarily because of the last line, in which we'll get to. But let me read this one, Some Grackles. One window pane only stands between you and what's out there. The lawn slowly filling with sunlight that stings your eyes a little, but you keep on looking anyway, waiting while coffee drips. One eye propped open and glassy like a stuffed bird's. And outside on the lawn, some grackles are milling, mobbing and strutting, flaunting their tails like soiled, shiny, suspect flags. That's it.
Oh, wow.
And
you know,
I'm particularly proud of the last line. So.
All right. You know, you stated that you hail from Oklahoma, I believe.
Yeah, I was born in Texas. I grew up partly in Texas, but a large part of my upbringing was, in fact, in Oklahoma.
How your roots in Oklahoma, how do they, in terms of your poetry, what happens there? Is there a connection?
Well, you know, like I said, it kind of goes back to one of the places, I have a poem about this I was hoping to work in at some point. One of the places that we lived when I was a child, my father was an Episcopal priest who actually joined the priesthood when I was about, well, he started seminary starting when I was about 5. And that takes 3 years. And when he was ordained, his first church was in a small town in North Texas called Henrietta. And that was my first experience of really being kind of out on the edge of things, because it was a very small town and with lots of open space around it. It was basically a ranching town. So you didn't have to go very far, and you already felt like you were practically at the edge of the world. The weather's very, very changeable and very, it can change very quickly. It can go from being very, very smooth and placid to very violent almost in a space of a few minutes. Not that it happened all the time like that, but you only have to go through a couple of those kinds of storms for it to make a really real impact. So part of it was the weather, and part of it is that sense of expansiveness and that just incredibly wide open space, and to be able to stand on the edge of town and look out to the west and see the sky meeting the ground, and it almost feels like looking into infinity. And that's something I've carried around with me for my whole life. And I've lived in the D.C. area now for, I think, about 35 years, longer than any place I've ever lived. And I love it here, and I love cities, and I'm basically now an urban person. But I miss those spaces, and they're still very powerful in my imagination.
All right. That's beautiful. Well, please share another of your works.
Okay, so this poem is one of the ones that grew out of it that I just mentioned. I mentioned that the name of the town in North Texas, and this could also stand in for some of the other places that I lived, but this is called Henrietta, Texas, summer 1964. I would have been 10 years old then, and this is not based on a single incident, but it's a sort of composite of some of my experiences as a small boy. So this poem is supposed to appear in an upcoming anthology about poems about small towns, but like many anthologies, it seems to be very, very delayed. So that part's on hold. But in the meantime, I still like the poem and I like sharing it. So this is called Henrietta, Texas, Summer 1964. A 10-year-old boy stands on the side of the street and looks down to the edge of town and beyond. Utterly clear, bright blue sky. Just one thin line at the western edge. Thunderstorms coming, maybe a tornado. But for now, the air is still dry and hot. He turns and goes back to the porch where he left his book. 2 hours later, the wind is clawing at the pages. Dark clouds are flying in fast, and dust devils rise and dance in the yard. Inside the dark house, still pondering where the afternoon went, he reaches for the light switch, then hesitates, eyes caught by the raindrops gliding slantwise across the window pane and by the dark outside and the deeper dark beyond. That's, like I said, sort of a summary of what it was like to be a boy, a sort of observant, sort of bookish boy in a small town in North Texas back in those days.
Well, you know, well, speaking of, that's a beautiful, beautiful piece. When did you first start writing, and what made you feel the need to express yourself this way?
Yeah, all right. You know, I'm going to back up on that one just a little bit. My first exposure to poetry that was not just nursery rhymes, and I don't mean to imply that nursery rhymes aren't absolutely wonderful, even for adults to encounter. Something that was a little more deliberately literary was when I was a very small boy, I was actually born in Dallas. For the first 4 years of my life, we lived in Dallas, and my mother's parents were there. My grandmother used to read to me from this beautiful illustrated volume of A Child's Garden of Verses by Robert Louis Stevenson. And by the time I was four or so, I was able to read to myself, and that was one of my favorite books. And there's a poem in there called The Land of Counterpane, where this Robert Louis Stevenson was a rather sickly boy, had to spend a lot of his time in bed, so he would create these games using his toy soldiers, and in the bed, and the counterpane was his blanket, and they would turn that into mountains or whatever. And it really struck a chord with me, because even though I was very healthy as a child, I got sick occasionally, like anyone would, and I used to do exactly the same thing. And it had never occurred to me before that anybody else ever did that, and particularly I had some inkling that this had happened many years before I was born. So it planted some notion of communication and reaching people emotionally across not just space but time as well. So somewhere after that, I'm sure I would have been writing poems in grade school, and for more or less for assignments, and I have a vague memory that it was something I enjoyed, and there were probably a bunch of them written in crayon stuck up on my, you know, on our refrigerator. But I think I started to kind of do it a little bit seriously when I was a senior in high school, because I had an honors English class where we read some poetry, and we had the teacher of that class was pretty advanced, and she talked to us. It was almost like having a college class in a way. So she encouraged us to express ourselves in different ways, and I started to get a real bug for more serious poetry. It wasn't, what I wrote wasn't any good for a long time, but that, I think that's where I started to get serious about it, was at the near the end of high school, the early days of college.
All right, beautiful. Please share another.
All right, let me see what I can, I'm just going to, this is something that I just wrote recently, and it's been on my mind because in a way it also has to do with those childhood landscape and weather experiences. This is not in first person. I have a short, this is the fourth one I've written. I have a short series of kind of turning into a sequence of poems that are kind of like dialogues between an unnamed man and an unnamed woman. And a lot of it is like he says, she says, but not in that sense of making accusations. But the man will say something and she'll say something that sort of deflates or enhances, somehow counters some of what he says. And it's sort of, I guess they're sort of a reminder to myself, because there's part of me in both of these characters. You know, I'm the one who can make pronouncements, but sometimes I also need to have that kind of thing deflated. So anyway, that's kind of a long roundabout way of saying what I got to in this poem was an example of the phrase first entering in my mind and then thinking about what I wanted to do with it, and then the memory of like the weather and being small and what that was like kind of coming together. And so this one is called Smells Like Rain. And it actually started because I stepped out of my house recently and it did smell like rain. And I thought, well, it felt unusually resonant to me. That, like, why,
all right,
why am I feeling shivery when I say that? So it eventually turned into this poem. Smells like rain, he says, and she, barely able to reach his hand, looks out across the clear sky at the thin line along the far horizon. Smells like rain, he says, and she, taller now, thinks of rain slanting through the wheat field ahead of the Oklahoma wind, hearing him whisper, please, Lord, don't let it be hail. Smells like rain, he says, and she, taller still, and with a child of her own, looks at him shrunken on the bed, eyes half open below his sweating forehead, his sister saying, open the window, child, and the slightest breeze ruffling his hair. Smells like rain, he says, and she whispers, smells like rain. And that's an entirely invented story, but I have to admit, I actually get the shivers when I read that to myself, because I feel like it really happened. You know, I mean, I start to love those characters. So,
you know, your titles are very, very intricate. Tell us about titling a poem. Why is that important?
Well, you know, I think because a lot of it, I know for me as a reader of poetry, I love poetry. I give a lot of my reading time to poetry, both in my own, whatever I've bought, whatever collections I've gotten. I now, of course, we're exposed to a lot of poetry, and a lot of it is good on the internet in different ways. People post things on Facebook, or I just browse around, and I go to libraries and bookstores, and I, you know, I pick up things. So the title usually is the first thing that grabs me, and if a title is intriguing enough, I will probably go a little bit farther into the poem. I may be disappointed, or I may be feel like, oh yeah, this was a really good thing to have gotten into. But I think the title is a way of, you know, especially there's so many things that compete for our attention, and even just so many different verbal things and so many visual things that compete for our attention, that a really good phrase that might make somebody stop and ponder, well, what does that mean, or what's going to follow from that, might get somebody to go a little deeper than just the title. And it is something that sometimes, like I said, like with some grackles and Smells Like Rain, I had that phrase in my head and then the rest of the poem followed. Sometimes I can get a draft down relatively easily and then just struggle for days with, well, what am I going to call this thing? So So to me, it's important. Occasionally, I will have one that's untitled or where the first line of the poem is actually sort of the title or vice versa. But I really try to give it a lot of thought because I think that's going to be the first encounter any reader has, unless I'm reading in person to them. So.
All right. Well, let's take a brief break and we'll be right back.
Sure. Okay, great.
Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Greg Luce. Greg?
Yes.
Name three of your favorite historical or historic poets. And what about their work are you most drawn to? And what about their work are you most inspired by?
Okay, yeah, that's of course, a wonderful question. I have many, many poets that I love, and some of them are contemporary, some of them are relatively recent history, and some of them are, you know, what you might call historical. So I'm going to focus on the further back ones. I think like any American poet, I would have to say Walt Whitman is a huge example and a huge inspiration. Where it is, as you well know, I'm sure, we are now celebrating his bicentennial.
Yes.
And all around the country and locally, there are many events celebrating Walt Whitman. And I recently, just a few days ago, participated in a marathon reading of Song of Myself, where a group of us, some of us poets and some of us just Whitman lovers, took turns reading sections of the poem. And we did it for about 3 hours and ended up just being absolutely blown away by the power of having the poem, not just experiencing the words, but all the different voices reading it, even sometimes in other languages. So I think he sort of made American poetry American. He got us in that we don't have to follow European models anymore. The language that we actually have is a valid basis for poetry. He certainly was heavily influenced by the Bible and Shakespeare and various other sorts of religious and mystical literature. But he created a voice in an idiom that was very much American. And it's impossible not to acknowledge that if you're an American poet, in my opinion, even if completely rebelling against this standard. Now, that said, I personally have found more of direct inspiration and direct help to me from his contemporary, Emily Dickinson, who, for a variety of reasons, for one thing, those really concise, really tight poems that contain just so much power are something that it definitely speaks more to my craft and my practice, but also the way she is able, again, in this very concise, coiled way, to express some really profound and disturbing emotions that I personally have experienced myself, also the wrestling with God and with spiritual questions, immortality, illness. I mean, it's remarkable that out of that voice, this very isolated woman was able to create such immense power in her poetry. And I've been able to actually take from her more directly things that I'm able to do myself. I would never compare myself to her except to say that I have drawn from her example in a much more specific way than Whitman. And then the other one, who's a non-English writing poet that I've always found to be very inspiring, and it's a little harder for me to say why I find him influential, but it's the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke, who I can read a little bit of it in German, especially if I have one of those bilingual books where I can kind of go back and forth from the German to the English. It isn't so much like his style or even the themes, although I find them both, you know, extremely powerful. There's something about as you read his work deeply and repeatedly, he sets the bar for what it means to be a poet really high. It's not so much like that it's a religious calling, but it's like this very high calling. So there's a lot of responsibility to really pay attention to things, to really name things properly, to use your best words, and to be like the role of poet. I don't want to mystify it or sound arrogant, but that it's a true calling, and it has a lot of responsibility and a lot of power. And somehow he sets that example for me. And I do, in fact, love the poems, but it goes beyond just the work.
You know, I can tell that you're very passionate about your craft. Do you think that you were meant to be a poet?
You know, that's always a good question. There was a time in my life, not even that long ago, when I was said, well, no, I mean, it's just I stumbled onto it, or I found out I liked it. A few people thought I was good at it. But, you know, I guess maybe because I'm older now, and I'm not as worried about what are people going to think if I say things like this. I think I was meant to be. You know, I mean, I wouldn't say who made it that way, who called me to be a poet, but I feel the strong inner drive to create poetry, and within whatever limitations I have, to be able to put my best words out there in the best way possible. So it is a calling for me. And it's hard for me to imagine. I mean, I love all kinds of art, and a lot of times when I get frustrated with writing, I say, oh, I'd rather be anything. Like, I really wish I was a painter or a musician or something like that. And actually, I would love those things, but I do know what I can do well. And if I allow myself to say, well, yes, I am an artist in words and not in paint and not in stone and not in music, but that's something that's very sustaining for me. And it's part of what helps. And you can talk about me. That's where the passion comes from, is thinking, this is something that I have, it's a gift, but I also have a great responsibility in how I use it.
All right. You know, you're a very fascinating guest, and I should share with our listening audience that if you'd like to talk with Greg, the number is 646-787-1631 if you have a question for Greg. So, Greg, at this point, please share another piece of your work.
Okay, now this is going to be a little bit different turn. As I think I was talking about, you know, some of my different themes, and you know, one of the things I have written much less about is, you know, political and social issues. And I tremendously admire poets who are able to do that. And it is not I am not an apolitical person, and I'm very moved by things that are going on. And obviously, I'm very, very troubled about where I see this right now. But it just isn't quite my bent to do this. But once in a while, something comes up. And within the last couple of years, I think with the Trump administration and with all sorts of things going on, I found it more necessary to make some statements in poetry about what some of these things are. So now I will say in advance, this poem has one F-bomb in it, which I'd be happy to elide over because I don't want to get anybody into trouble, and it's not too critical.
Okay. Freedom of speech.
So, okay, great, excellent. So this one is called An Unquiet Life, and it has an epigraph from Langston Hughes. And that was for reading this statement that I'm about to quote Langston Hughes is what gave me the idea. It was almost like, you know, like a nudge in the ribs, like, you know, Greg, you've been doing very nice things about this, about clouds and weather and the sun and your girlfriend, but, you know, there's all this other stuff going on. Maybe you have something to say about these things as well. So this is the quotation from Langston Hughes. Poets who write mostly about love, roses, and moonlight, sunsets and snow must lead a very quiet life. Langston Hughes. So this is called An Unquiet Life. I want to get back to writing about thunderstorms and the sky painted with Monet clouds, or that color the sky turns right after the rain stops, or the broken melodies of catbirds erupting from deep within bushes, or that electrified feeling I get riding in metro with Dolphy or Mingus pulsating in my ears, or the way lights reflected on the river remind me of my lover's face after we make love. But these days, when I imagine clouds, they're always dark. And Jesus, it feels like it's been raining all summer. Birdsong still makes me run to the window or stop my bike. But the joy flies away as fast as the birds themselves. And soon I'm back to brooding and scowling so entranced by the scroll of outrage is unrolling on my screen, I forget to look up. My headphones can't drown out the angry chatter rattling inside my head. And everywhere I see handmade signs and torches, people walking around with clenched fists, muttering through clenched teeth. Each day's headlines are more bizarre than the day before, and lately fucking Twitter rants contain more poetry than I can dredge up out of my battered, fatigued imagination. So I write. I try to keep it real, stay awake even when my eyes feel like they've had thumbs pressed into them, write when my head pounds, about to burst like an overripe fruit, when anxiety shoots its shocks, when the pen feels like a baseball bat in my quivering fingers. Just write. So that's my, it's almost an admonition to myself more than anything else. So as I said, I felt moved by that Langston Hughes quotation. And actually, with your permission, there's a very, very recent poem that I completed within the last several weeks that came directly, not so much directly out of a specific current event, but playing off another poem by a poet that I have recently sort of discovered and who I've come to admire a great deal. I'm quite sure you've seen the work of Jericho Brown, who's a really, really fine American poet who happens to be African American, and his work reflects that, among other things. And if you'll again bear with me, I'm trying to find. Okay, so let me pull that one up. And what happened was recently I happened to be, I don't own a car. I live in Arlington, Virginia, which is, for some of the readers who are outside, our listeners outside the area, is basically the D.C. area. We're just across the Potomac River from D.C., and it's rather urban here. I don't own a car, so I take buses a lot. I take trains a lot. And I, actually, on a side note to that, I often get some of my best ideas while riding mass transit. And we can talk about that a little bit more, because I know sometimes you ask about where people like to write. But in any case, I was riding the bus just across Arlington on a Sunday, two or three Sundays ago. And, you know, so you've got like 20 minutes of sort of enforced idleness riding the bus, and it's a very familiar route, so it's not like there's much to see that's interesting usually. So I was looking at my phone, and I was scrolling through Twitter, and somewhere along the way, somebody had posted a link to this poem called The Tradition by Jericho Brown, which is the title poem of his most recent collection. And the entire book is absolutely magnificent, but this one hit me right between the eyes. You know, as a Caucasian American who is deeply, deeply upset and moved by the racist things that we have to deal with in our culture, and who yet I'm not really personally at risk, it's very hard to know what can I do, and without sounding like I'm either looking for some sort of absolution from people of color, or if I feel like, oh, I've got to apologize for what my ancestors did. You know, it's a difficult thing, and I'm not looking for any sympathy for this. But one of the things, the upside of that for me is sometimes I can use my words and I can use my imagination to at least begin to cut through some of that. So having read this poem, I literally sat there using the Notes app on my iPhone and typed out the original draft of this poem, and then I did a little bit of fine-tuning. And so I ended up with this poem, which is called After Jericho Brown. Sunday morning, gray, on the bus, one of those poems. One of those poems. Jericho Brown, The Tradition, in my Twitter feed. Sudden choke, salty eyes, sit there in voiceless grief. And I think what I found so profoundly moving about his poem is it's not much longer than the one I wrote. And he talks about, he's using some metaphors from gardening. He mentions the names of some flowers. And at the very end of the poem, he lists three names of young black men who were killed by police, including Michael Brown. And it was the shock of that at the end. I could barely contain myself sitting on this bus. And I had to respond in some way, and that's where that poem came from.
Well, let me ask this question. what do you see as being the role of a poet in modern day society? And you've kind of talked about it, but what is what is our role? What is our role?
Okay. Well, you know, the way I see it, and you're right, I have alluded to it, but to pull some of those thoughts together, one thing is, you know, if you go back to that first poem that I read called Just Look, one thing is just to point things out and show how beautiful the phenomenal world is and how so many ordinary things that you walk over, walk past, don't pay attention to are so, you know, like they deserve more attention. Sometimes because they're truly beautiful, sometimes because you see things, it'll make you see the world in a different way. And then working up from that, I think part of our job, and I'm not the baby the most skilled at this, but it's certainly something I strive for, is to also bear witness in some way. I mean, I don't think I can write a poem that's going to make somebody, that's going to make 100 people make signs and go down to the White House, but I might be able to at least inspire people to think about, you know, what's really going on. And it, you know, my idea is not so much to point fingers and say these people are doing evil as much as it is to look at, okay, first of all, how does it affect me? And particularly in the case of some of the things like what my Mike or my Jericho Brown poem is about, is like, how am I complicit if I don't do something? If I don't say something, if I don't respond in some way, am I complicit in the very things that I claim to be, you know, struggling against? So I feel like there's a sort of, you know, it's a sort of dual thing. And sometimes I lean more towards, okay, I'm going to write about beauty, or I'm going to write about weather, or I'm going to say, look at the way the building looks against the sky at exactly this time of day in Washington, D.C. But on the other hand, you know, people are being beaten, murdered by authorities because of the color of their skin, or children are being taken away from their families because they're coming in from the wrong part of the world. You know, I can't ignore that. And even though I can't change it, you know, there's a, just something about maybe waking people up, but also to interrogate my own privilege and knowing that I don't have to worry about any of those things happening to me.
All right. Share another piece of your work.
Okay, let me see. I'm going to have one. Okay, thank you. This is something that I had been, I just pulled out just because, I don't know if you were going to ask this specifically tonight, but, you know, the question about what are, like, say, several poems of mine that I'm most proud of, this is one, it's, again, relatively recent because, and it, this may speak to some other questions you have down the line, it represents something I don't do very often that I would like to do more of, which is not to just sort of hint at something, but to actually tell a story. You know, in other words, bring some kind of narrative. I mean, I'm not trying to write a novel with this or even a short story, but to tell a story in a more narrative form and yet still, one hopes, you know, have it come with poetic, how it come out in poetic concision and poetic language. So, oh, and one of the themes that's common that I did not mention earlier when you were asking me about it is alcohol. And this is a poem that's very much about alcohol. I actually myself stopped drinking almost 23 years ago, but as I like to tell audiences when I read poetry in person, it's one of those love affairs that even though, like, you're out of it, you never forget it, and that lover is always haunting you no matter what else you've gotten onto, no matter how many years later. So every time I think, one of my books is called Drinking Weather, and it contains a lot of those kinds of things, and every time I think I'm done with it, then I'll get another idea. So this is an example of that, but it also does try to tell a story. Again, this is 100% fictional in terms of the events, but I think it gets at some of the kinds of feelings and some of what it was like back then. So this is called Through the Fumes of Whiskey. Like fallen power lines drifting in water, her hair floated toward my face, but stopped just short. I started and froze. She spoke. Stop asking fools for what you had and lost back there in Texas. I stared and sniffed and caught the scent of whiskey and another, the smell of air after rain. What are you wearing, I asked. Eau de bourbon, a lair? A weak attempt, but she smiled slightly and went on. Texas is Texas, and everybody is from somewhere, and you could get another drink. She was right. I was half-drunk myself and not getting there fast enough. I found the bar. When I turned around, she was right there. I couldn't get past her, so he sidled. A pair of snakes trying to emulate a stare in Rogers toward a dark corner. Ice cubes tinkling like broken keys in accompaniment to our jagged choreography. What do you know about me in Texas, I asked. Her eyes went vague. Oh, you know, people say things. I felt a sudden chill and thought someone had opened the window. Luckily, the bourbon was working and rekindled some warmth. She was looking off toward another corner, eyes half closed, maybe trying to make someone out. I have to go see, she mumbled a name I couldn't quite catch and faltered off. I noticed her boots for the first time. Her right foot kept slanting sideways as she stumbled across the room. I felt a bit rickety myself. Home or another whiskey? I made my way haltingly toward the bar. I think one other thing I should mention about that, as far as how the genesis of that was, there's a couple of lines that are attributed to this female in the poem where she says, stop asking fools for what you had and lost back there in Texas. I was going through a notebook that I had, a little pocket-sized notebook, the sort of thing I used to, like, jot down kind of what I was up to on a particular day. Not the same thing as a notebook where I might write poetry or put down poetic ideas, but I was reviewing it. I had not looked at it for some months, and I went back, and I found two or three, these strange sentences that I have no idea how they got there. I mean, they were my handwriting, so I knew I must have written them. But was I quoting something? Was it something that came to me in my imagination? I honestly had no idea. And I thought, well, I've got to use those somewhere. So the one I used first was this, stop asking fools for what you had and lost that back there in Texas. I couldn't make any sense out of it. But when I put it in the context of two people who were kind of drunk, kind of interacting, it began to make sense.
Oh, wow. I'm thoroughly enjoying listening to you share.
Thank you. I'm enjoying sharing. So,
I'm really, really, really pleased. What advice would you give to an aspiring poet? You've published extensively. What advice would you give to someone who's just a budding poet? What would you share with them?
Okay. Well, yeah, and you know, actually, occasionally I do run into some people that fit that description. You know, just the first thing I say is just write, just plain write. You know, don't worry about how good it is. You know, keep a notebook, write down your observations, follow the impulse to write. Don't worry too much at first about how good it is. But obviously, you know, be hard on yourself, craft, show your work to other people, you know, workshop your work, whether it's with one other person or a group. Doesn't have to be in any formal academic setting, but get together with a group of like-minded people who also might be trying to write. And, you know, there's this famous statement by Henry James that I've also, you know, because he was a novelist, but I've realized that I've been trying to live by this for most of my adult life, where he says, be someone on whom nothing is lost, meaning pay attention to everything, and you never know when something there is the kernel for something that you can go further with, like in the case of what I just read, some weird sentence that I wrote for God knows why. But on the other hand, I see a certain way that the sky looks on a given night, or I'm sitting outside and I hear a catbird singing, and suddenly, like, the whole world opens up. You got to be open to that stuff all the time. And so you always carry your pen and pencil, always carry some paper or notebook, and like, keep your eyes open and write whenever you can.
Wow. Let's take a brief break, and we'll be right back.
Certainly. Great. Thanks.
We are back. This is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Greg Luce. Greg, let me ask this question.
Certainly.
Writers and poets write for a myriad of reasons. Some write primarily to speak a message to their audience. Others write because to stay silent is not an option. Why do you write?
a little bit of both of those things. I think when we were talking earlier about, like, my passion for writing, or, you know, did I feel that I was meant to be a poet, I think these
yes.
things need to be said, and in the sense I can't keep them inside of me, and I'm just egotistical enough to think that at least once in a while, once they're said, someone else will read them for some pleasure or profit or both. So it's definitely out of a need to get it said, and it's also out of the hope of this will take the next step into somebody else's, you know, into somebody else's eyes and their brain and their consciousness.
All right. Well, share another piece of your work.
Okay. I was just looking around here during the break, and I realized something else I didn't really mention is one of the, like, huge things that is in it's important in my life as a whole, and it's something that I have actually written about quite extensively, is music. And I think I sort of alluded to the fact that sometimes I'm like a frustrated musician. I basically have no musical talent except that I can kind of sing a little bit. But
right.
I love a lot of different kinds of music, and I am particularly fond of jazz, and especially, like, the two people that I put up highest on that particular, you know, in that world are John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk, both of whom I've written about it more than once. And I also have written about Eric Dolphy. I've written about other forms of music besides jazz, but I keep coming back to jazz. Also very fond of Charles Mingus. So I've tried to get at least some of the rhythm and some of the sensibility of that kind of music, and also just to say what it means to me. So I have a poem here that, you know, refers and it speaks to that, and it's a way I have of expressing that. The poem is called Lush Life, and, of course, that's the title of a very, very famous and beautiful composition by Billy Strayhorn.
Billy Strayhorn, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
who
I know it.
Is like, I don't think has ever been, as he's well known among music buffs, but I don't think he's nearly as well known as he should be, because he's definitely one of America's greatest, songwriters and lyricists. And he provided so much amazing and brilliant work to Duke Ellington. And Lush Life in particular, I think, has been popular with a lot of singers and a lot of other musicians, because there's a lot of things you can do with it. So I know Coltrane recorded it as an instrumental at different times. There have been many singers that have done it. But for me, well, the poem says how I feel about it. So let me go with that. This is based on the version from the album John Coltrane and Johnny Hartman. Lush Life. It has to be Johnny Hartman, with Crane framing that voice that flows smooth and rich, like a river of barrel-proof bourbon, rippling with McCoy's chords, Jimmy and Elvin's beats popping like ice in a glass. And the wheel of life starts rolling you back through the gay places, the low dives, finally the side porch, sitting alone late at night, that pint bottle at your feet, almost exhaling whiskey breath, you running your finger around the rim of the glass, tracing each bead of sweat sliding down the sides, pressing it to your forehead to cool the sudden flush that starts just at the hairline, hands trembling a little now, though another small splash into the glass, slivers of ice tinkling as your hand shakes, the lush life in this small circle of light. So that's mine. You see how I've made it both a tribute to the music, but also it personalizes it, like, what, not just what it means to me as a beautiful song, but how I can identify elements of my own life with what's expressed in it.
You know, I asked the following question with trepidation, because
sure.
I know that poetry is subjective, but what makes a poem good? What makes a poem good?
All right, yeah. Well, you know, obviously there's probably a lot of answers to that. It's a very legitimate question, as long as you're not looking for, like, the one secret.
No.
I think that certainly, I mean, if whatever makes it good, or whatever makes different poems good, has to have, first and foremost, it has to do with the language. The words have to be, you know, like the best chosen to express what's being expressed, which doesn't mean fancy words. It doesn't mean combing through the dictionary for seven-syllable words. You know, as you've noticed, most of my language is not particularly ornate. And one of the things that I've done over, 20 or 30 years of practice, as I really got serious about this, is squeezing down the work to the, not, I wouldn't say the exact minimum, but to squeeze out things that really aren't necessary and to make the words as clear and precise and understandable as possible. So I think any poem has to sort of have that. Beyond that, it might need, certainly if it's beautiful in some way, through some sort of a rhythmic pattern or through rhyme or through some sort of musicality, like you can listen to Yeats being read or read Yeats out loud to yourself, and you'll be utterly caught up in just the musicality of it without even thinking about what the words say, and then of course eventually you'll come back to that level. But so certainly great poetry has that, that element in common with music quite often. Could be beautiful imagery. It could also be something that might make a poem great would be making a person see something in a way that's completely different. And I know I brought it back to my own, my own aesthetic, but I think that's one of the things poetry does. It causes us to re-look and re-listen, re-smell what we take for granted around us.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, please share another piece of your work.
Okay. I want to do another musical poem, and again, another one that was inspired by my love for John Coltrane. This is my favorite piece, or that is my favorite piece, or that's my favorite record, because his work is just unbelievably rich, and there's depending on the mood I'm in, I can always find something that's going to get inside of me and move me incredibly. But one of my favorites, of course, is A Love Supreme, I've actually seen it twice. There's a wonderful documentary called Chasing Train that is about the life and work of John Coltrane, and Naomi, who you interviewed last week, and I went to see that when it was in the theater here in the D.C. area, and then it recently appeared on Netflix, so of course I watched it again, and I have a feeling I will probably watch it many times. But being inspired by that and having these fresh examples, not just of the music, but actually being able to have some of his life, unspool in front of me like that, got me thinking again. And so I wrote a poem called Return to a Love Supreme After Chasing Train. The stairs to heaven are uneven, some broken. You go sideways sometimes, take a step down for every two up, but you climb and stumble, always grasping the pure beam of light that he sends back from somewhere he is, always up ahead. I try to work my pen for train the way he played his sax for God. So I was trying to get into a little bit of that sort of spiritually moving element that I feel when I encounter Train's music.
I'd like to hear that one again, to be quite honest. That last line really struck me.
Okay, I'd be happy to do it again. Again, this is Return to a Love Supreme After Chasing Train. The stairs to heaven are uneven, some broken. You go sideways sometimes, take a step down for every two up, but you climb and stumble, always grasping the pure beam of light that he sends back from somewhere he is, always up ahead. I try to work my pen for train the way he played his sax for God.
John Coltrane hails from my hometown, High Point, North Carolina.
Oh, does he? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. It's funny that he and Thelonious Monk both came from small towns in North Carolina and then moved relatively young up to northern cities. I think Train ended up in Philadelphia first and Monk went to New York. But I wonder somewhere secretly if there isn't something about that background, those roots in the border South, not really the deep South, but the border South, what that might have meant to them musically. I don't know if that's if that can be answered, but it's an interesting thing to think about.
All poets have several words that come up over and over again, words or sentences that they just can't help but use in their work. What are three of your most absolute favorite words to use in your work?
Okay, well, clouds. That's a good one. Probably music. And then there would be the subset of, like, things more specific. But just the word music, I mean, I've got a few poems where that word itself is pretty important. And then I'm thinking something like, maybe even something, maybe I don't use it that often, but it's something kind of in the back of my mind a lot of the time would be yes. You know, because I try to, like, say yes to life and what it offers. You know, it was in that opening poem from my first book,
yes.
And yes. And so I think there's a yes in a lot of my work, even if the word isn't in there. And I mean that in the sense that it actually is not just something that somebody would infer, but it's kind of rattling around in my mind. I think one, you know, I mentioned Rilke early on when he talked about influences or who I really admired. He talked a lot about saying yes. And I think that's kind of what I was trying to get at earlier. I said he had a particular kind of influence on me.
Oh, wow. Please share another.
Okay, let's see. What have we got here? I wanted to read, I mean, there's so many, you know, I mean, I've written a lot. So, but this is one, I think, it's because the occasion is still relatively fresh. My mother died in March of 2011. It was not a sudden death. Fortunately, it was not a very protracted, painful death. But in any case, it wasn't a shot. So myself and my siblings, we did have a little time to prepare for it. She was living in Dallas. I couldn't be there when she died. I had to go immediately after. But my point is that she died at the end of March. Her birthday is April 23rd. And then Mother's Day comes in the early part of June. So that period from late March to mid-June, even now, like 8 years later, is still, I wouldn't call it painful, but I still feel it. And I'm very aware of her not being around. And we had a really good relationship for about the last 20 or so years of her life. Not that it was bad before, but we had gotten to this really wonderful, you know, healthy place. And so it was very difficult to lose her. And I still often filter my life today of, like, what would my mother think about this? Or I wish she was here to hear or see this. So I wrote this poem kind of around the time, close to the anniversary. It was sort of between her birthday and my birthday. No, actually, it was getting close to her death date. So it was at the beginning of that period. The title and a couple of the phrases in the poem come from the Gospel of John. There's a passage when it's the night before the crucifixion, when Jesus he's trying to console his disciples because they sort of know what's coming and they're very despondent about it. And then there's also some language. I was raised as an Episcopalian. I think I mentioned my father was an Episcopal priest. So there's some liturgical language from the burial of the dead service that's in here as well. So I say that because some of the words might sound a little bit archaic or a little bit not quite my normal style, but also those are not necessarily reflective of my current spiritual beliefs, but they were very important to her, and they're very appropriate in connection with writing about her. And also, they're just beautiful language, whatever you feel about the content. So all that is a kind of a long introduction to a short poem called "Whither I Go, Ye Know." 8 years since my mother died, still seems like yesterday. In the midst of life, we are in death, and oh Lord, don't I know it. When blooms are bursting, pollen flying, world without end, amen. Though I'm not so sure of whom may we seek for succor. It's thinking about my mother and about death and the possibility that it's not too consoling to think about death in light of what people have told you it is. So I like it. I don't like to think of it as like gloomy or negative, but it's ambivalent.
Oh, yes. I can understand. Yes. You know, we're closing.
Yes.
We're almost at the finish line. And
yeah,
I could listen all night. I cannot believe the hour is going by so quickly.
It really
I could
is,
listen
yeah.
all night.
Well, great. Well, I could talk. Believe me, my friends will tell you I could talk all night. But it's probably good that we find a reasonable cutting off point.
All right. Well, let me ask this one last question that I always ask.
Certainly.
When
sure.
people hear your work, they usually
yes.
want more. I know I want more.
Okay.
What's
I
next
so.
For you
yeah,
as a poet?
That's my
What's
sorry,
next for you as a poet?
Well,
yes.
You know, I don't know. I'm just kind of like, I don't like plan out and project stuff. I just want to keep writing. And, you know, I do have some manuscripts. Like, I do have a chapbook size, almost, it's almost there, a near chapbook size manuscript of my poems about music called Riffs and Improvisation. And I just need to get a couple more done and into that. So if anybody out there is listening and has a small press that would like a chapbook of poems about music, certainly get in touch with me. I also have a chapbook manuscript of just some work that has not been previously collected. So I'm going forward trying to, you know, I still like to get books published. And, you know, I would like to do a little bit more maybe on the narrative side. I've also been dabbling a little bit in actual fiction, which is kind of an interesting challenge, and something to take it up at my age is especially challenging. And as long as it doesn't take away from my poetry work, it's something that I enjoy doing.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for being
Absolutely.
Here, and I'd like to invite you to come back.
I would love to. Just say the word. I may have a
all right,
all right.
stuff.
All
right.
So thank you, Michael. It's
all right.
been a real honor to be
yes.
by you. So.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Well,
good night.
Good night. Good night, Greg.
Yeah.
And good night to our
all
listening
right.
audience.
Nice. Thank you. Good night.